is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, the good news is everything seems to be going up. Oil is over $40 a barrel, gold is back up to $12.50, and yes, folks, everything is going up, including the stock market. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava. Welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. In Hour 1, Ralph Ancampora will join me, and he's positive on the stock market, and wait till you hear what he has to say about stocks. A totally different take in terms of whether this is a bear market rally. You're going to want to hear what Ralph has to say on that. Ryan Poplava will be joining me here to also explain what happened on the markets this week. Rob Bernard on interest rates and some good ideas for investors seeking yield. And then Robert Rapier will be joining us. He thinks energy prices have bottomed as we discuss the energy sector on this Friday. But believe it or not, oil prices close to $40 a barrel. All that coming up in Hour 1.
And greetings, everybody. Hour 2 of the program. By the way, I'm John Loeffler. You know, the Fed met this week, and it came as no surprise. They stood down. They didn't raise interest rates because last year they were telegraphing after they did that little quarter of a point rate hike that they were going to do it again and again in the coming year. Well, here we are in the coming year, and they haven't done it. Maybe what happened in the beginning of the year in the stock markets, they were astounded at what happened, the reaction of markets and elsewhere to just a quarter of a point rate hike, and decided, well, maybe we better hang off on that for a while. So we're going to look at that as a big part of the big picture today. What is it the Fed knows that we don't know? Why have they decided to stand down? What are the data that they are looking at? And then in the third part of the big picture, why we have slow economic growth? You know, one characteristic we've covered here on the program over the last 7 to 8 years is how anemic this economic recovery has been. Many of the average people out there are saying, well, you keep telling me we got economic growth, but I sure don't see any of it. I don't have a job, you know, or something along those lines. So we'll look at why, all right, there's been some of a recovery, but it's been very, very anemic. It'll be information packed today. All of that coming up on the big picture in Hour 2. And as we always do at the first part of the program, Ryan Poplava. Ryan, it appears the Federal Reserve is not quite as data dependent as they decided this week not to raise interest rates, despite the hot inflationary data you've been pointing out over the last month, as well as the employment rate near their long-term goals of around 4.8%. And the last reading we had was 4.9%. So it seems the Fed is allowing the economy to run just a little hot. Would you say that, or you think they're really more worried about what happened in January?
They're still pointing out, John, the economic and financial developments across the sea. So globally, they're still very sensitive to things. They left that there in their policy statement this week. So that's why they're maintaining rates where they are. I guess in this new world of transparency that we got from, you know, Bernanke's days as the chairman, we have been asking for targets. You know, we need some goalposts for the Fed. We need to understand, okay, you're going to make some changes. What are you basing that on? And et cetera. It would be nice. But really, we can't put the Fed in a box. The economy is a rather complex thing with a lot of moving parts. It just isn't that simple. So, you know, for us, you and I, John, to come in here and say, here's the goalpost. Nope. Yeah, there we go. They moved them again. You know, I just have to give them a little bit of grace in that. But, you know, I don't agree that the Fed should pin this all on the global markets. I don't think you can hold off so much on what's going on there. Like you said, based on where employment is, where inflation is, we are running hot. We are essentially above or better than the targets that the Fed gave and that we have been measuring the Fed's policies off of. We started seeing some economic contraction in the U.S. data in early January, John, and that was when I started hearing the R word being used. You know, China's currency, current account issues, slow growth there definitely was a major concern in August. That caused the Fed to kind of hold off on a September hike. Remember, we were talking about a September hike back then. Didn't happen. The markets actually got really nervous thinking that, oh, shoot, maybe there is something amiss here. And that's what happened. And we got that again in January. So there definitely is that. But no, the U.S. economy did slow in some respects. Manufacturing actually contracted, not decelerated, from an expansionary reading as we saw late last year. It actually contracted in some of the readings. Since then, we've seen an improvement there, and that's definitely a good thing. As I mentioned over the last few weeks, the problem areas that got us into the earnings recession, as I've been coining it over the past quarter, I'd say, the things that got us into that mess, they're considerably improving, John, and that being the reversal in the dollar strength and a reversal of declining energy prices. Energy prices have stabilized. So, you know, reversal is probably too strong a word. Rather, maybe I should say stability. We've got some stability in both the dollar and some stability in energy prices, and that's definitely helped the markets here.
Okay, well, let's talk about the run-up to date in U.S. and global equities. We've had a long list of policy adjustments from the Bank of Japan, the Federal Reserve on pause, and the European Central Bank last week, as well as many adjustments by the People's Bank of China to help stimulate the economy. So while it has appeared to help reinflate asset prices and equities, I think many of our listeners are asking, is this really as good as it gets?
Yeah, and that's been the case for at least a year. You know, I think the one thing that worries me, John, is that Mr. and Mrs. Central Banker, you know, just put them all in one group right now, essentially doing what you can to maintain confidence in the markets. They've done that. But John, you know, the S&P's earnings, as I said, we've been in an earnings recession. How much can the Fed, in all of its stimulus actions, by essentially just going on pause? Really, that's all they're doing, right? They're leaving interest rates low. That's great. Allows us to, you know, borrow at reduced rates. That helps housing. That helps auto sales. But, you know, I believe the 12-month forward estimates for the S&P's earnings are at 116, and those have dropped from the fourth quarter. And, you know, I've been really hitting that for quite a few months now. And essentially, you know, what has taken us into that area? Yes, it's stabilized. But if the bulls want to continue this secular bull market, if we want to break out of this trading zone that we've been in for a year and a half, essentially we need those earnings to bottom and we need them to reverse and head much higher. We need outright growth, and we just don't have that right now. We've had some recent catalysts. Like I said, we've had a stabilization in those two problem areas I've already mentioned. You know, a freeze on OPEC's production was a very key catalyst that has helped sentiment on energy. It has helped stabilize prices, but we continue to hear from Iran that they're likely not going to adhere to those essentially agreements by OPEC. There's a lot of rumors there. So prices in oil, I expect to continue to be volatile based on headlines based on that. And then there's also the central bank policy divergence that we've had in place since 2014. And Mario Draghi last week basically said the ECB felt further accommodation may not be needed. So that was another new kind of chip on the table, another puzzle piece. And that was their attempt to kind of jawbone expectations. So that helped recently. The Fed's estimates on rates and the market's view, essentially taking those, what the Fed is doing with remaining on pause and the ECB saying, hey, we may not need to do more. That policy divergence trade, that gap has really narrowed. And that was what was helping strengthen the dollar. So, you know, we definitely got a really big piece in that puzzle last week. And then again, this week with the Fed statement. But, you know, the recent update on catalysts helping stocks was the dot plot estimate this week. And those expectations towards rates for essentially the end of this year, where the Fed thinks rates will be 2017, 18 and beyond. You compare that with what the market is predicting with the Fed futures, essentially that gap we needed to narrow. I've been hammering that for weeks that the Fed is based on the December dot plot. They were estimating 4 rate hikes this year. the market, Fed funds futures, were predicting maybe a 50% chance in December. That was the highest amount of certainty. That gap has narrowed because the Fed essentially expects at the end of this year what looks to be maybe 2 rate hikes instead of 4. So that gap narrowed. That was, again, another catalyst that has helped the markets. That's why after Wednesday, the market improved. Equities headed higher. And, you know, that was definitely a catalyst that has added to that puzzle. But John, going back to that earnings issue, you know, the S&P's earnings, the PE ratio at the beginning of this year was 16.9. Right now we're at 17.66. And I don't know if I feel all that much better about the U.S. economy today and the outlook than I did 3 months ago. So I think that's still an issue. I think valuations are going to be a big concern until earnings can reverse.
All right. So you feel like there's been an improvement in some of the conditions that caused the January correction, but you know, you still sound doubtful that we're going to get much improvement from here. Am I reading that?
All the catalysts, you know, everything is piling up since February. We're 2 months into this rally. You know, I think with the exception of manufacturing, you know, manufacturing has improved. And I think that's clear. You look at the Philadelphia Fed survey that came out, the Empire State survey that came out, and we've seen the ISM numbers for January and February, and we see that those have improved. And it's very clear that, as I've mentioned many times, inventories and manufacturing, very cyclical, the relationship between the two. Inventories get drawn down, then, well, manufacturing needs to ramp up. Finally, that's starting to happen. And that was a piece of the puzzle that we have not had for some time. A lot of the bears have been pointing towards the deceleration there. And we had outright contraction in December and January, I believe. And essentially, that is improving. That's a really good sign. And it points towards further improvement, which could spell great news for GDP growth here this quarter and the next. But you know, the weakness in the dollar is probably the most important condition to me, as that could be prolonged if foreign central banks stop their accommodative moves, and if the Federal Reserve continues to pause. If this policy divergence narrows and stays right where it's at, doesn't get any worse, then that could be very beneficial for U.S. multinational large cap stocks and the S&P's earnings. And then on top of, obviously, with a weak dollar, commodities are allowed to rise. That's going to let your energy prices rise. That, again, too, should help S&P earnings. But to that effect, you know, it appears the ECB has said, like I said last week, that's all. Japan downgraded its outlook recently this week, but they didn't make any policy adjustments. You know, I think they're really trying to see what negative rates did or is going to do. Like I said last week, there's this lagging effect with policy changes and then when and how that affects the economy. So they probably don't want to go deeper into negative territory, you know, based on the backlash they got in early February. And our central bank, like I said, basically said, we're not clear on the outlook. So essentially, this policy divergence issue, that's a very positive thing right now in the sense that it isn't as wide as it used to be. It's very much narrowed. But like I said, earnings are a big issue. And if those don't improve, then I feel like there's going to be this rubber band kind of moving stocks back down. And then you've got the rubber band from all these central bank moves helping to prop things up. But you know, the central banks can only do so much, right? And you look at, there's a lot of articles out there talking about the disparity. And I can really, gosh, I'm going on a soapbox here. But the disparity between the wealthy who own assets and the non-wealthy who don't own assets are living paycheck to paycheck. The only asset they've got really is their house, if that. This disparity between the rich and the wealthy and then Main Street and Wall Street, that's definitely, you know, an issue with central banks making all the moves and not fiscally with governments. You know, the G20 a couple weeks ago, I didn't see a lot come out of that. They didn't say, yeah, we're going to do more, but what? What are they doing? What kind of government moves are helping to stimulate the economy besides just, you know, creating inflation with the monetary system? It just, you know, there's a lot to be still to be wanted here in the situation of the global and U.S. economy.
You know, it was interesting because Stuart Varney on Fox Business this week was saying pretty much the same thing. He said the central banks are out of moves. He said the only thing left now is for governments to admit they have to cut taxes in order to make this whole thing work. He said, but nope, we haven't gotten to that point yet. So that's where he pretty
totally
well left
agree.
It. Yeah, because he said that's the only thing left that's going to stimulate.
Yeah, and you've got the Fed which is trying to get back some of its policy moves, right? Its main one is lowering interest rates if we get a problem. They don't want to go into negative territory. Clearly, you know, we saw Yellen's testimony about a month ago, but essentially they're trying to get those tools back, right? They want to raise rates so that they can lower them eventually. You know, it's so funny.
It really is. And it actually reminds me of that very famous scene from Atlas Shrugged, you know, where John Galt is out. The proposal is to make him the chief economic czar. We'll do anything you tell us to do. He said, okay, we'll cut income taxes, abolish them. Oh, no, we can't do that. And so everything he comes up and tells them they need to do, they go, we can't do it. But anything else, we'll do what you tell us to do. You know, and it's one of the greatest scenes in the whole book. Anyway, what are you looking for near term in the markets to be able to decide how you're going to allocate your clients' money?
Well, I think the central banks are out of moves. I totally agree right now. I think they've shot their shots at trying to fix things right now. I think they want to see how the markets react, how the economy reacts. Like I said, there's a lag effect. So without more catalysts from the central bank on the horizon, I think that will leave the markets really dependent on three things, John. Economic news, which, you know, you and I will always point towards each week, what's going on there. Technical analysis, we've got obviously guests who are on the show every week to really discuss that point. And then valuations, as I mentioned, you know, the PE has run up. You know, that's going to rubber band and kind of detract if we don't have a feel-good environment. If we have the feel-good environment, if you've got sentiment continues to improve by the consumer and investors, well, then those valuations can head higher. But like I said, there's a lot to be wanted on the economy currently. You know, I can't predict on the economy. However, like I said, many signs are pointing towards manufacturing ramping up. That's a good thing for GDP. Job growth seems to be steady. We had that one drop in January that was a little nervous when we announced it in early February. Housing and retail is holding steady. You know, auto sales, John, I've seen many point that that may be a bubble. There's been some discussion about subprime lending in that sphere. Let's just say conditions are improving overall for the economy. And that's the one positive besides the already known catalyst of a weak dollar and stable energy, which we've already discussed. I guess technically we've had a steep rally and volume has been dropping off. That tends to happen when a move gets a little extended and overbought in this sense or oversold. There are some good things I see that are technically happening that might improve the long-term outlook. John, like one of the things I've been pointing out to my staff even is that the S&P 500 nearly, I think I looked at it today, 92% of the S&P is trading above its 50-day moving average, which really isn't that hard given how much we've fallen in January. But I haven't seen that kind of participation and breadth is what we call it since, you know, the good old days of 2013, which, you know, that was a pretty nice year. So it's really good to see that in this rally, there's a lot of stocks that are participating. But as I said, technically, we have been in a trading range for large cap stocks. I continue to feel that that is how you need to treat this market. I don't agree with some of my peers that we're in a bear market. I think there's some things that I haven't seen be confirmed, and I haven't seen maybe this is a topping formation. Topping formations do happen and take a lot of time sometimes to occur, but I don't think convincingly we've broken down yet in all of the indices. Yes, clearly small cap did it for a little bit while there. We're back now above, I think, the 200-day average today, I think, and the transports as well have staged a phenomenal rally. But technically, I still believe we're in a trading zone, so you have to treat it as such. You know, remove risk near resistance, add risk near support, real basic stuff, but you know, emotionally it is hard to apply. I've been doing that since August and will probably continue to operate in that fashion for our clients. And the final thing is valuations, John. Like I said, I'd say that the catalyst that will not allow the market to reach new all-time highs is valuations until we get more clarity on earnings from the S&P. And like I said, the PE is higher today than it was late December, and that makes me a little nervous heading into the current highs, you know, where we're at currently. And that, I believe, should act as a weight on any, let's call it, quantitative pleasing by central banks that essentially have been propping up stocks, trying to add financial stability, which was needed. I mean, you look at the credit default swaps that were up a few months ago, financial stress indexes that we've been following were elevated and were kind of alarming in February. That has since improved. So there's some good things, but a reversal of the earnings recession would be a feather in the bull's cap. And right now, that's been plucked for now.
That's a good framing then, Ryan, as to where we are for now. Hopefully we'll see you again next week when we know this will all change again, right?
Yeah, like I said, technically things are a little overbought, and I mentioned that last week, and here we are a little higher, but on lower volume. And I've alarmed listeners before, be cautious when we get in these areas. I know it's hard to feel like you've been left behind. Maybe you're all the way in cash right now, and you know this ramp up in the market has made you nervous. Be cautious still. And look for opportunities. One of my old colleagues used to always tell me, you know, you buy into weakness and you sell into strength. And, you know, chasing the market when it's up 5% in a week, not the thing to do. You know, wait for pullbacks, make sure that things stabilize, and then add some risk if that's suitable for you.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
Well, the year has turned positive after a steep sell-off at the beginning of the year, a small little rally, and then another downturn. Stocks are finally gaining some momentum. Joining us on the program is Ralph Ancampora. Ralph, the consensus seems to be that what we're seeing right now is a bear market rally. We've had this rally in the past. We had the steep downturns last August and September, got back up again, but at a lower high. And then, of course, at the beginning of the year, we went straight down, a small little rally, went down again, looks almost like a double bottom if you're looking at a chart, and now it's up and away again. So from your work and looking at it, I know last time we spoke, you were a little bit more positive. Do you still hold that positive view? If so, why? And is this a bear market rally, or is this the beginning of something more?
Jim, that's an excellent question, and I'm glad you asked it because, you know, like everyone else, I read other people's market opinions and, of course, listen to the talking heads on television, which I enjoy, CNBC and all those places. And I get the same impression that a lot of us technicians are saying, yes, it's a kickback rally, whatever they call it, and going to run into a lot of overhead supply, which I totally agree. In fact, the Dow is starting to approach it right now. I think the supply in the Dow is around 17,500 to 18,100 or 200, right up in there. And we're on the verge of pushing into that now. So, yes, I agree with part of that statement. I agree that we'll get a little extended. We'll definitely get overbought, which we're approaching right now. And we should have some kind of a sell-off. Where I disagree, and by the way, I was in that camp for a while. I'm very concerned about the first part of this year. You know, the S&P was down 11% between January and the middle of February. The DAX index was down, I think, 15%. The NASDAQ was down 14.5%. You know, it was very bleak. But I disagree with the majority now. And the reason why I do that is because over the last few weeks, you've seen this market broaden out very, very nicely. And it isn't just the S&P kicking back or just the U.S. stocks kicking back. It's across the board. I see emerging markets doing very, very nicely. I see crude recovering very nicely. I think crude was as low as, light crude was as low as $27. And, you know, now it's up over 40, you know. Sure, it's a little extended short term, but I think the lows that we put in, call it a double bottom, whatever you want, I think will hold. Now, the subsequent correction, which I agree should happen in the next few weeks or a month, I don't think makes new lows. In fact, if I'm right, then you can have a higher low, and that's very encouraging longer term.
Let's talk about Dow theory. We had divergences. We had the breakdown of the transports. Now we have the Dow going back up, but the transports are also going back up. Is that a good sign?
Oh, they're on fire. But see, what Dow theory needs is another test of that low, the February low. And I think, as I mentioned a moment ago, I think we get a sell-off in the next few weeks or a month from now. And I don't think we make new lows. And in the case of Dow theory, if that happens, even if one of them makes a new low, unconfirmed, that's an important word, unconfirmed by the second, that's the beginning of a bottoming out for Dow theory. So I think also, looking down the road a piece, I think Dow theory will start to flash a potential shift from bear to bull.
You know, what's interesting, Ralph, at the beginning of the year, we had just about every asset class going down. As you mentioned, all the major indexes were getting hammered, not only here, but overseas. You had the commodity complex where oil touched down into the 20s. You had gold get down to below 1,100. Now, in addition to stocks going back up, you just mentioned oil's over $40 a barrel. Gold is at $1,250. So it seems like when you say a broadening, it's not just in, let's say, equities. You're seeing it even in the commodity space.
Oh, yes, it is. It's very impressive. I think people should stop, take a look at these reversals. I'm even seeing it in individual stocks. IBM was a classic. That looked so bad early in the year. And it just turned around from a low of about 118, something like that. Now it's 148. I think I can reach us. I could not see that recovery from 116 to 148 or 46, where it is today. Those turnarounds are very impressive.
Yeah, even, you know, you take a look at the consumer staples area. I don't care if you're looking at Coca-Cola or Procter & Gamble. I mean, Coca-Cola is at an all-time high now.
Yeah, the first part of the year, I think it dropped down to low 40s. 40, I think, and now it's 45, 46. Yeah, very, very interesting. You know, if you start looking at the headlines and say, well, gee, okay, Yellen comes out and says the Fed's not going to raise rates four times this year, only two. And then you have this fear of global recession is lessening. I'm not an economist, but I hear that talk out there, which is different. That was not the discussion. Remember, China was going to have a hard landing first half of the year, and it's going to reverberate throughout the world. And I think the headlines improving on that basis. And that's all very, very encouraging.
I want to get your take on commodities here, and I want to look specifically at oil and then discuss gold. We saw oil drop nearly 70% when you consider it was over $100 and got down to the mid-20s in earlier part of the year. Now, as you and I are speaking, oil has finally touched $40, which has got to be a breath of fresh air for the banks and a lot of these oil companies. But it is at close to $40 a barrel. Now, I don't know if the market is telling us that supply and demand is going to be eventually balanced. What's your take on oil here? Does this look like it has some legs to it?
Great question. Again, oil hit a low first half of the year, I think, was around $27 a barrel, like crude. And now you're up a little over 40, as you mentioned. When I look at the longer-term picture of crude, again, just like the rest of the market, you're going to run into a lot of supply at some point. And I think the supply in crude is roughly right about where we are now, I'd say in the low 40s. So like the market, I think it's approaching overbought. I think it's a little overextended, probably consolidate maybe in the upper 30s, low 40s for a short period of time. And I think moves higher, again, based on the fact that we've had a very orderly, very broad-based recovery since the February lows. And no, I think crude has made its bottom.
Now let's talk about gold, because when you look at the price of gold for more than 3 years, the price of gold has been dropping and it got down to a low earlier in the year, just as we saw in the price of oil. But if you look at a chart of gold over the last 3 or 4 years, it looks like, to me, Ralph, it's breaking out of a long-term downtrend. And that, to me, says something significant is going on here.
Yeah. In fact, as you were talking, I pulled up the monthly chart of gold, you know, where it peaked out at 1900 a couple of years ago. And it's been in very strong downward bias ever since. And this recent rally up took out that trend that you're talking about. Now, like most things you look at now, I'd say gold's a little extended short term, runs into supply right about here, up at 1,200, 1,300 area. It'll probably slow down, consolidate. But I think the bottom that we saw earlier this year looks impressive to me. And this is the first time I can say that in the last several years. I've been actually very, very negative on gold for a while. So if anyone's interested in accumulating some gold, I think on weakness, that wouldn't be a bad idea. Especially if you look at the dollar. And the dollar, I'm not super bearish on the dollar by any means, but I think it looks heavy. I know it's been under pressure the last few weeks, which has helped the gold and crude prices in the last few days. But I think the dollar at least has a ceiling on it. So that bodes well longer term for commodities.
When you look at what we're seeing now, you've got oil prices, which hit a bottom, are now back up over 40. Gold prices, which hit a bottom, now gold is close to 1250. You've got the S&P, You've got the Dow, you've got the transports, you've got emerging markets, you've got other markets all rising. This is a major sea change when you see all of these asset classes rising at the same time. As a technician, when you see something this broad, what does that indicate to you?
As I mentioned before, the concept, or at least the theory that a lot of people were espousing the first few months of the year, was this global problem. Now, again, I can't speak with any real confidence on my part talking about whether Germany has a problem or not, but they were part of the discussion, as Europe was. And then I think a lot of that has changed, and I think that's what's having such an important impact on the commodities and the markets in general. And that's why you're starting to see, I think, significant changes in trend. Now, again, I have to say that, you know, we've had a very nice move short term. So we're starting to stretch it a bit. So if the market were to back off in the next month or so, I think the true test comes then. And I'm leaning that the lows hold and across the board, including commodities, oil, gold, and emerging markets and things like that. I think the second, if that happens, then let's say we flatten out or go to a trading range April, May, and June, I think that could set the stage for a very, very robust second half of this year. And I think if that were to happen, I think the leading averages here in the States, like the Dow and the S&P, I think could pop to all-time new highs. I need that the successful test. What I just said separates me from the super bears in the technical world.
You know, Ralph, over the years, you have picked up on some trends. A good example would be right around 2012, 2013, where we saw stocks like Intel, Microsoft, a lot of the technology darlings of the tech bubble, which went nowhere for 13 years, start to break out. Is there anything that you're seeing now on an individual stock basis or a sector? You mentioned IBM, which, you know, got down into the low 100 teens, and now it's back up close to 150. Anything that stands out to you that you're seeing in the charts?
Well, I'll talk about a negative. A little disturbing what's happened to biotech. That was a leading group for several years. And of everything I look at, I'd say be careful with those. I don't think that their problems are over. Okay. On a positive basis, you're right. It was a while ago that, being the old man that I am, I started looking back at older stocks that the kids don't even talk about anymore, like Texas Instruments and Intel and Microsoft and things like that. They still look good. There's lots of room on the upside. Lots of room. Even the banks, by the way, I think, talking about a turnaround. I like to look at the ETFs like the XLF, the financial sector ETF, starting the bottom. And that's important. We need the financial. So the older names like JP Morgan, Bank of America, I think are buys.
So if you were expecting this pullback, you're saying things are a little bit overstretched right now, stocks pull back, what would you be buying?
A lot of what I just mentioned. Of course, some stocks that might have gotten ahead of themselves and, you know, just you might have missed them. You know, if you're interested in, let's say, an IBM, you know, wait for a pullback. I think you can get IBM maybe at 135 instead of 145. And, you know, some of the bigger names that flagged a little bit and didn't participate, and it's still a little sluggish like Apple. I think Apple is bottoming. That's a name I would look at. It's participated in this rally, but not as vigorous as other things. Facebook, kind of lumping along. That's a name, I think, for the longer term also should be in your portfolio.
You know, you and I are old enough, Ralph, to remember that, you know, dividends have always played an important role in terms of total return in the stock market. In a world today where you have negative interest rates in Europe and you have negative interest rates in Japan, when you can pick up a dividend yield of 3%, in some cases 4%, there's nothing wrong with that. And we talked about oil heading to $40 a barrel from where it was at the beginning of the year. What about oil stocks? Because this is a sector that you could say really went through a bear market. Some of these oil stocks were down 70%. What's your take on the energy stocks here?
Well, I like the big ones, like Chevron. Chevron is close to breaking the peak that it made in 2015. I think it was 98. Stock's about 96 right now. Oh, yeah, that would be very impressive if it takes that out. Oh, then you're talking about 115, 120 on the upside. ExxonMobil, yeah, that's a huge long-term base. Anything above 87, and the stock's 84 right now, I think you're talking mid-90s. Those are two names right off the bat that I would look at.
Well, listen, Ralph, as we close, I wonder if you could fill our listeners. You and I were talking before we went on the air. You're doing a video. Most of the classes that you teach at the New York Institute of Finance are live classes, but you're working on something new. You're working on a video. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, the New York Institute of Finance wants to take the class global, which I think is a great idea. By the way, the school is part of Pearson Financial, so they have a very huge global educational footprint. And in the process of doing that, I think I'm going to record it in May. And I'm bringing in all sorts of different levels. For example, the Chartered Market Technician, CMT levels 1, 2, and 3. I'm going to bring pieces of those exams into my class. I'm going to bring some renowned technicians to say a few words about their specific specialty in technical analysis. So it's going to be an all-encompassing video when it's completed. I don't know when that'll happen, but I will have a live class in May, and I think we'll still do the live classes, but the video I think is going to be very, very interesting.
Well, I look forward to seeing it. Ralph, listen, as always, we appreciate you coming on the program. You have yourself a great weekend.
Thank you, Jim.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
Pat Nipper, the director and senior technical analyst at Renaissance Macro, joins us today. And Pat, when we spoke to you, I believe it was last October, you had warned our listeners that we were seeing credit conditions deteriorate across the globe. And there were certainly a lot of alarming signs that we could point to in terms of that deterioration. And of course, moving from 2015 into 2016, the first part of the year, there was definitely a lot of disturbances in the market. Saw one of the worst records on start for stocks here in the U.S., and I know global markets took quite a hit as well. Recently, we have seen a bit of an improvement in the credit markets, whether or not we're looking at the U.S. or Europe or even Japan. Credit spreads have backed off from their highs slightly. So from your vantage point at Renaissance Macro, do you think that this is telling us an encouraging sign moving forward? Do you see this as just being a relief rally? What are your thoughts?
Well, Chris, really the tricky part of dealing with any bear market is when you have a rally like this, you see a lot of short covering. You do need to look and see what the credit indicators are telling you. And the reason we like credit so much is because it's not subject as much to retail psychology, if it were, as the equity markets are. So we look to see what the smart money in credit is doing. And you're right, we have seen some improvement off of the low. If you look, there are certain pockets where, for instance, credit default swaps in the United States have improved. And we've also seen CDS in Europe improve and Japan. They haven't improved enough to really break the downtrend that they've been in, or actually, you know, in the case of CDS becoming more expensive, the uptrend. And so when we look at that, and we also look at a triple B spread, and now we like triple B because it's right on the edge with investment grade and junk. So you really sort of get a good sense of what the risk on, risk off mentality is. You know, we find that junk sometimes can be a little too noisy. And, you know, if you look at, say, triple A spreads, for instance, you know, those don't tend to widen until, you know, you're already in the middle of a calamity. So triple B is really a good sweet spot.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
Well, the Fed met this week, but let's talk about interest rates. Joining us on the program is PFS Group's Rob Bernard. And Rob, just give us a quick sort of rundown what rates look around the globe. I imagine much lower than where they were at the beginning of the year.
That's correct, Jim. The U.S. 10 years, 187. United Kingdom, 144. France, coming in at 0.55. Germany, 0.21. Switzerland, of course, is still negative at 0.35, and Japan is negative 1/10 of 1%.
You know, it just absolutely astounds me, Rob, when you think about where we were back in 2011 when we were talking about Greek bond yields at 30%, Portugal, Italy, you know, 10, 11%, and now you're talking about France at 0.5%, Germany. It's absolutely amazing. Given where we are, what are investors doing? Because there's obviously no value left in sovereigns. I mean, do people really want to tie up money in Switzerland and pay the Swiss central bank interest? I mean, what are you doing for yields right now?
Well, Jim, funny you ask, because, of course, our 10-year is still a safe place for all these wary world bond buyers. But here at home, we are actually looking for values and finding values in our corporate bond market.
In the corporate bond market, I know credit spreads have widened. That's one of the main things. Everybody is focused on the fact that the Fed raised interest rates a quarter of a point in December. But going back last fall, Rob, corporate bonds really started to widen.
Well, that's true. Corporate bond yields started to spike. The prices, of course, fell a little bit, showing signs of a caution. And that caution light continued to flash. And after a lot of our analysis, we came up with that, hey, there's great value here. And we actually started putting some of this great value to work in our clients' portfolios. In some cases, we're able to get short yields, and this is 3 to 5 years, in upwards of 4.5 to 5% in some cases. Good value that was not properly transmitted through the system.
So, given the fact that corporate bond yields have widened, Rob, what are we talking about in yields today? I know a year ago, we were looking at corporate bond yields that were in 2 and 3% range. Are they much higher than that today, or what are we talking about when it comes to corporates?
Well, there again, it depends on credit quality, where they are in the yield curve. But as I said, mostly somewhere between 4 and 5%. But normal corporates that are, say, double A rated, single A rated could be as little as, you know, 3 to 4%. But we've been able to find some gems, and we do our due diligence, and we put those rascals in the account. One thing that also we do to increase the yield is by what I call cash arbitrage positions. And these are defined as buyouts, cash. So, for example, a large utility company may buy a distribution company and they will say, we'll pay $60 a share for it, but it's going to take us a while to get all the regulatory things through. And while we're waiting, we may buy that stock at $56, $57 a share. But while we're waiting, we're collecting dividends as well. So it tends to stabilize the value of the account in general because it's less volatile because those stocks are in play. And when they actually come to the final line, the end zone, you might say, we realize quite a handsome rate of return with very minimal amount of volatility and risk.
So, Rob, when you say you're playing this arbitrage, a lot of acquisitions are made for stock, but what you're going for, you say here, is strictly cash, and explain the reason why?
Well, the ones that I find are just strictly cash deals because if they're stock and cash, they tend to get negatively arbitraged between the hedge funds. And therefore, it's kind of a messy transaction, you might say. But when there's cash, that tends to stabilize the entire transaction and you know exactly what you're going to get and when you're going to get it. So it's almost like a proxy for a bond, if you will.
So given corporate bonds and arbitrage, anything else that you're finding in yield? You know, it's amazing given the fact that, you know, we got used to 0% interest rates. Now the world has gone to negative interest rates. I mean, it's really hard to find yields out there today, wouldn't you say?
Well, it is because you've got to remember the United States is the only one that has talked about increasing interest rates. So we pretty much are an island and surrounding us are, of course, Japan negative and Europe is flirting with negativity or very little rates of return. Canada, Australia, their interest rates are lower as well, but the currency isn't as strong, of course. So in that particular case, the United States 10-year bond is creating a lot of chatter around the world because why would you want your money parked in France at 0.5% when you can put it in the United States at 1.87 for the same time period, but have a stronger currency as well?
You know, you talked about arbitrage in these corporate takeovers. You talked about corporate bonds. What about dividend-paying stocks? Anything that looks attractive in terms of yield? I know utilities are notorious for paying higher dividends, but there was always a risk with the utilities if interest rates were rising. So what are you finding in the stock area?
The stock area is very attractive to consumer staples. Because if you can eat it, drink it, smoke it, turn it on or off, or talk on it, that's going to be very, very risk adverse to the market in general. And those dividend paying stocks tend to raise their dividends more often than not. In some cases, they can raise their dividends at about 10% per year.
So, summing up, Rob, as you look at this market right now, you can still get yields. You talked about earlier corporate bond yields. And when you're looking at corporate bond yields, when you're talking about 3, 4% yields, how long are you talking about maturities there? Because there's always a risk if you were to go out 10 years and get 4%, what if rates do back up? You could lose some money.
Well, that's a very good point. We go not much more than 10 years in maturity. And for that, depending upon the issue, we can get anywhere between 4 and 5%. And that's a rate to maturity. So I feel very comfortable of ascertaining those kind of yields in this type of marketplace.
Okay. Well, listen, Rob, if our listeners would like to follow your work or contact you, how could they do so, please?
Thanks, Jim. They can contact me at 888-486-3939 is our toll-free number. And just ask for me, Rob Bernard.
Well, since hitting a bottom in February, oil prices have been marching higher. On the day we're doing this interview, prices are approaching close to $40 a barrel. So is the oil market sniffing out that we're close to a bottom, or is this simply a bear market rally? Joining us on the program is Robert Rapier. And Robert, let's talk about the price of oil. One of the reasons we got into this supply glut, obviously, was the increase in American production, which has been the most significant producer of oil in the world the last 4 or 5 years. And so the thought, Robert, was that as drill rigs came down, eventually the oil markets would balance out. But we have a new equation on the geopolitical side with the entrance of Iran back into the oil markets. So from your perch, as you see this, is this run that we currently have seen from the mid-20s to where we are today the beginning of the bottom of the market, or is this simply a bear market rally?
Well, I mean, oil prices have gotten a little ahead of themselves if you look at the state of inventories worldwide. But I think traders are looking down the road a little bit. I mean, from a fundamental standpoint, we should have never gotten into the 20s. But, you know, OPEC is dumping a lot of oil on the market, and the U.S. put a lot of extra oil on the market. But from a fundamental perspective, and by that I mean the marginal barrel costs more than $20 to produce. The marginal barrel probably costs $50 to produce. So, you know, from a fundamental perspective, we have to get back to that sort of level to keep growing production. And, you know, in the U.S., the rig count did fall dramatically, and production has fallen off slowly because basically they collapsed to the very sweet spots of all the shale plays, and so production hasn't come down as quickly as was expected to. And at the same time, OPEC was putting more oil on the market, and then there's the threat of Iran to putting more oil on the market. And so you can see it play out in global inventories, and that's what I always look to, regardless of who's doing what. If inventories are going up and they're high and they're going up, you can expect downward pressure on oil prices. And that has been the case for the past year. We've had high inventories and, you know, we get a little relief through the summer. But, you know, by the end of last summer, shale production hadn't fallen all that much. And so we saw inventories start to build back up again. And so we're sort of sitting on record level inventories. Again, we're just at the cusp of summer driving season, high refining season, so inventories will start to come down again. The question is, will shale oil production come down fast enough between now and, say, the end of the summer so that when the low demand season kicks back in, that we actually do start to pull those inventories down? That'll be the key. And, I think traders are looking at that right now. They're seeing a balanced market, and that's what I've seen the balanced market coming like 6 months from now, maybe 9 months from now. And I think traders are bidding oil prices up ahead of that. But if inventories stay high, something is going to have to give. you know, there's going to be no place to put oil, and you know, there's going to price is going to have to come back down.
So when you look at this kind of current rally, it sort of began around that time period when Saudi Arabia and Russia were talking, and then there was the idea that was floated, okay, we'll freeze production at current levels. We won't increase it anymore. But when you talk about Iran coming into the market, and Iran is saying, look, we're not going to freeze our production. We want to take it back up to where we were prior to sanctions, which was close to 4 million barrels a day. That's an additional 1 million barrels coming onto the market. Robert, what does that do for the market? Because even though U.S. production has fallen, what, about 600,000 barrels a day, it's decreased. But you now have Iran ramping up to increase production by a million barrels. So doesn't that keep the market weak?
Yeah, I mean, I think year over year, U.S. oil production is going to be down by about a million barrels a day. So I think it's going to pretty much offset what Iran is putting on the market. The problem is we're overproducing already. So even if those two wash out, we're still producing too much oil globally given demand. You know, even with a million barrels coming off the market in the U.S., we're still producing a lot more oil than we were just a few years ago. So supplies are still pretty high.
You know, this brings up an interesting question, because there's the thought of, well, if oil prices ramp up, then, you know, U.S. shale producers will come back online, therefore always keeping the market oversupplied. But there was an article in the Wall Street Journal this week talking about many shale companies are unable to ramp up oil output. And the reason they give, Robert, is many of these independent companies are too financially strapped and have had to let go too many workers. They've idled too much equipment to immediately ramp up again. And also the balance sheet of these shale-only producers maybe need to be repaired before they can come on. In other words, if you're over-leveraged and can barely pay your bills, it's unlikely the banks are going to want to extend you new money.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of them are in pretty bad shape. You know, it's always the case. Whenever you lay everybody off, you can't exactly ramp things back up quickly. And it's going to take a sustained level of higher prices, I think, before you see production really start to pick back up in the U.S. You know, we always overshoot. We overshoot to the high side and we overshoot to the downside. And the longer we stay on either end, the more we're going to overshoot. And I think the longer we stay sort of at sub $40 oil, the more it's going to hurt companies and the more companies are going to go out of business. And therefore, you know, when demand does catch back up to supply, we're going to see an overshoot to the high side.
So when you take a look at this, let's look at the other side of the equation. We've talked about supply. One thing that we've seen as recently as on Wednesday, the Fed lowered its economic targets again for the year, lower economic growth. The IMF and the World Bank has been doing the same for global economic growth. A lot of major economies are slowing down. Japan has been in a recession. China is slowing down. So where does the demand come from to balance out the other side of supply?
There's still a lot of developing countries, India and Vietnam, and there are a lot of smaller countries that are actually cumulatively consuming a lot of oil and are growing at double-digit rates in their oil consumption. So I expect to see some slowing in growth, but it's still going to grow. I mean, I think nobody has forecast that oil demand is actually going to decline, even though some people have, you know, misrepresented that. They hear growth slowing and they think demand falling, and that's not the case. It's just demand is not growing as fast. Over the past 30 years, oil demand has grown about a million barrels a day every year. And last year, it was significantly higher than that. So, you know, if we only grow by a million barrels a day this year, and the latest forecast I saw was 1.2, you know, it's about the average over the last 30 years, the average demand growth. It's just slower than a very robust demand growth in 2015.
You know, when we look at the markets as where they are today, one of the problems that we've seen over the years is the major oil companies, I don't care if you're looking at Exxon, Chevron, BP, Royal Dutch, they're not producing as much as they used to. They are a smaller share of the overall oil market. But the problem that all these companies have is when you produce a barrel of oil, you've got to replace that barrel of oil. You got to go out and find new barrels. And we know for companies the size of Exxon, Chevron, and the majors, there's just not too many large oil deposits that are being found today. So you would think with prices this low that you would see more takeovers. I know that the hedge fund industry is raising money. In fact, the former president of EOG has just started a fund. He's raising $100 million or more. I think the figure is $400 million, to start buying oil properties because he sensed it as a buying opportunity of a lifetime. Robert, why do you think that we have not seen more companies make acquisitions, especially for companies, you know, the size of Exxon that still have good cash flow?
Well, the problem is there's not enough companies like Exxon that have good cash flow. I think we will see Exxon, and you know, Exxon itself is still digesting XTO, the big purchase that they made a few years ago at the which anticipated very high natural gas prices for years and years and years. And I think they're still having some indigestion from that purchase. But I think they are probably in the best shape here to go out and buy some companies. There are a few that are in okay shape, but there are not a lot. And, you know, the reserves replacement that you talked about, it was really poor for big oil this year. Some of them didn't replace any reserves. I think it was BP or Shell One that replaced no reserves at all. So all the oil they produced came off their reserves. And then on top of that, they had to write down some reserves. So reserve replacement was negative for one of those companies. And for others, I think most of them didn't replace their reserves. So, you know, it's a struggle for all of them. It's going to be a struggle for many of them to go out and acquire properties because they are in the same position, you know, dealing with $40 oil that everybody else is. It's just, you know, some of them like ExxonMobil, they do have deeper pockets. They do have still generating okay cash flow. Although Exxon, I'm looking at them right now, they're negative over the past 12 months. If I look at the top 10 oil producers in the world over the past year, the only ones that have positive free cash flow, Shell does and Lukoil. Those are the only two publicly traded companies in the top 10 that have positive free cash flow over the past 12 months.
So given that, if the hedge fund industry is moving in this area, why not some of the bigger oil companies? Because certainly they can still generate or have access to capital because, you know, the best time to buy something cheap is when it's distressed and at bargain-based prices, which is where we find ourselves today.
Right. But, you know, they're making forecasts, too, and they may expect that we're not out of the woods yet. So they may think maybe they can get a better price. I think people overestimate the ability of some of these oil companies, and for OPEC, for instance, to predict oil prices. I can promise you OPEC had no idea they were going to drive oil prices down to $40 a barrel. I think whenever they made the decision to keep the market supplied, despite some pressure on prices already, I think they thought they might knock prices down to $60, bankrupt a bunch of shale oil producers, and then they'd recapture their market share. And that's, of course, not what happened. And they drove oil prices all the way down into the 20s and hurt them a lot. But I think it's the same maybe for ExxonMobil. Maybe they're expecting, you know, it's premature that we've gotten back to $40. It's inevitable that we will because, you know, it's going to take sustainable price. It's going to be $50 or $60 or something like that. But as long as inventories are high, something's got to give. And I think they recognize that. And they're probably projecting that we're not quite out of the woods yet on oil prices.
So given this market right now in several of these companies are dealing with cash flow problems, where does this industry go in the future? Because I just told you the Wall Street Journal talked about many of these shale producers are in no condition financially to ramp up again. And it seems to me the longer this goes on, you know, we talk about the Middle East is better able to sustain lower oil prices. So, Robert, you know, Saudi Arabia may be able to produce oil at $4 or $5 a barrel, but when you take a look at their governmental cost of running the government, they need close to $30 a barrel. They've gone through over $100 billion of their reserves. They're talking about maybe even taking Aramco public to raise some money. So, you know, I don't think even countries like Saudi Arabia or Russia or some of the larger producers can sustain these kind of low oil prices for an extended period of time.
Yeah, and if anyone ever tries to argue that OPEC didn't make a huge miscalculation, just look at the fact that they're talking about taking Aramco public. That would have never happened had they not made such a massive miscalculation on oil prices here. And so, and I've made the argument in the past that, you know, this has cost them $500 billion last year. It's going to cost them another $500 billion this year. You know, Saudi may be able to produce some oil barrels at $5 or $10, but their marginal barrel is certainly not that. Their marginal barrel is quite a bit more than that. So, quite a bit more. It's probably, you know, $20, $30. They are producing some oil for $20 or $30, but as you say, they have to balance their budget, and their revenues come from oil. So they're hurting. Everyone in OPEC is hurting, And I think they would like to talk the price up without having to do anything. They're notorious for that, trying to talk the price up or talk the price down without actually having to take any action. And I think part of this production freeze and talking about cooperating with Russia, I think that's a lot of that is psychological. They're trying to get prices to a higher level without actually sacrificing any production.
So given the nature of where this market is now and where you think it may be going, it seems to me we're setting ourselves up. As you pointed out earlier, Robert, we tend to go to extremes, either on the downside or the upside. That's been the nature of this market, at least throughout my investment career. I can remember back in the 80s when we saw $10 oil when Saudi Arabia was overproducing. I can remember 1998 when it got down to $10 a barrel. A couple of years later, it was at 35. And so we've been through this before. The problem with oil, as the Wall Street Journal article talked about, there's been, some close to 300,000 people have been laid off in this industry. This isn't an industry that can flip a switch and start the taps begin flowing with oil again. Are we at risk at some point, whether it's 2017, 2018, who knows when the year will be, that oil prices spike and we go in the opposite direction?
Absolutely. And if you look back, I mean, historically, prices change very quickly in the oil markets. You know, if you look back in 2008, say, in the beginning of 2008, we're at $100. By middle of 2008, we're almost at $150. Nobody was predicting $30 by the end of the year, and yet that's where we were. And then within 14 months of that, we were back over $100. So that's how quickly things can change. Now, it's not going to change as quickly this time because the buffer there is the very, very high level of oil inventories. But as oil inventories start to come down, you'll see more volatility and you will see some sharper price movements. But we're going to have to pull oil inventories down a little bit before that happens.
So in the meantime, what would you be doing as an investor? As I mentioned, the hedge fund industry is raising money as they sense a real opportunity here. It kind of reminds me, Robert, of what happened during the housing crisis in 2009. You saw hedge funds raise money and just would go into areas like whether it was Florida or Las Vegas and buy large swaths of real estate developments at distressed prices. They're doing the same thing now with the oil markets. So what would you be doing here as an investor? Would you be waiting for a bottom, or are there attractive opportunities that are safe enough to invest in?
You know, I think some of the major oil producers, especially some of the integrateds, I think they're okay buys at the moment. You know, some of the larger ones, ExxonMobil is probably an okay buy at the moment. I myself have been buying some EOG resources. I think they're one of the best run shale oil companies. Their financials have deteriorated a little bit over the last year, but you know, I think as oil prices recover, they're going to recover nicely. But one sector that has done quite well in performance, not share performance, but actually financial performance, has been the midstreams. The midstreams have suffered enormous correction, and yet most of them are still raising distributions.
Robert, let me stop you there. For our listeners, explain a midstream company.
So a midstream, a pipeline company. So we're talking about some of the master limited partnerships like Enterprise Products Partners, Magellan Midstream, some of those guys, the guys that move oil and gas around. And many of them have done very, very well. They're raising their distribution. They pay a decent yield, but they've suffered an enormous correction mainly because of the expectations of future growth. As oil and gas production start to decline, then the expectations that they're going to continue to build out infrastructure got tempered, and so they corrected down across the board. But their performance, they have continued to generate good free cash flow, and they've continued to raise distributions. So, you know, many of these companies have done quite well. So if you're looking for a sort of conservative to growth play in the sector, I'd be looking at the midstreams because I think they've corrected far more than what was warranted based on their financial performance. It's mostly in sympathy with oil and gas prices, but most of them don't have direct oil and gas exposure. I mean, you can get upstream, like an oil-producing MLP, and those have gotten obliterated. I mean, some of them are on the cusp of bankruptcy. But the midstreams, the pipeline companies, the infrastructure companies, they've, for the most part, done quite well, at least in generating cash.
So given this, and is there some risk? I know some of the midstream companies, some of the pipeline companies like Kinder Morgan had to reduce their dividends dramatically. In fact, in the case of Kinder Morgan, they reduced their dividend by 75%. So are there some risks there?
There's one that's got a lot of debt. So, you know, that's definitely something that you need to be aware of is who's got a lot of debt and who doesn't. And Kinder Morgan had a lot of debt. So I think that's what got them more than anything.
All right. So in terms of investment, some of the majors like an Exxon might be a safe bet here. Some of the more growth quality companies like an EOG, there might be a little bit more risk, but also maybe a lot more reward on the upside. Anything else you would be looking at?
You know, again, like Enterprise Products Partners, that's one of the major midstreams. I think they're a good place. You know, if you're a little bit more risk tolerant, you can, I'd say risk tolerant to, you know, high risk tolerance. Some of the smaller oil producers, they're the ones that are going to bounce back, you know, very, very hard when oil prices go up. But they're also, you know, quite risky at the moment. I think the refiners have done well and they'll continue to do well as prices are low, but they're going to suffer with oil price recovery. And I would guess that probably, I haven't checked Valero lately, but something like Valero is probably getting their margins squeezed here as oil prices started to recover. So those are the ones that I'd avoid in an oil price recovery scenario. But I think you're okay with the midstreams. I think the best strategy, I think, is to dollar cost average in. And this is long term. This has been my strategy, is if I feel like oil prices are under a sustainable level, is start to buy into, you know, some of the oil producers. And when I think it's overpriced, which I did at the beginning of 2014, I felt like oil prices had gotten too high and I was worried about a correction. And so I started selling off some assets. And as we came back underneath $50, I started adding back to positions. I mean, you can't really time tops and bottoms very well. It's very hard to do. You're lucky to be able to do it, you know, more than a couple of times in your life is really get a good top and bottom. So I prefer just to, you know, shift money in stages. I'm looking over our best buys. You know, we have a portfolio that I help manage, and our best buys are pretty loaded with the midstreams. So Energy Transfer Equity, Magellan Midstream, Enterprise Products Partners, those are, you know, some of the best buys, and those are all midstream master limited partnerships.
All right. Well, listen, Robert, so given where oil markets are right now, you think the current price may have gotten ahead of itself, but do you see oil prices maybe trading in a range between 30 and 40? In other words, do you see another drop down into the 20s if inventories continue to build?
Well, if the inventories continue to build, they'll have to. I mean, we'll have to take a dip down again, but psychologically, it's hard to see us get back down to that level, especially right now with us going into higher demand season. So, you know, inventories will peak. They peaked within a month of this date last year. Inventories peaked and started to come back down. And so I would bet that we're not back down into the 20s. I think by the time summer driving season is over, I think demand will have increased a little bit more. U.S. production will be down a little bit more. And I think we'll be closer to having a balanced market. And as inventories start down in earnest, I think the downside risk then is mostly gone. We still have a little downside risk at the moment, but, you know, if we drop back down into the lower 30s, I'd view that as a buying opportunity. I mean, that price can't sustain. You know, the market can get out of whack for a while, and it's been out of whack for, you know, a good 6 months here, but it can't stay there. And we're going to have to recover back to $50 or more to keep oil production growing.
All right. Well, listen, Robert, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, how could they do so, please?
Well, I write for several outlets. My main home is at Investing Daily. I write a column called The Energy Strategist. It's a subscription column that publishes twice a month. I publish two free newsletters every week, one called The Energy Letter and one called MLP Investing Insider, where we talk about master limited partnerships. And then I write a column for Forbes. I've got five times a month. I have a column there that comes out. And then I have a blog called Energy Trends Insider, which I write usually on a biweekly basis, just general happenings in the energy business.
Well, the Federal Reserve met this week, and no surprise to anybody, they stood down on their promise to raise rates. Remember, after raising interest rates for the first time in a decade last December, the projections were for four more rate hikes this year as the Fed attempts to normalize monetary policy. But it seems like they have revised their projection down to 2. So the question that we're going to ask on the big picture is, what does the Fed know that we don't know? How is it viewing the data, since it says that it is data dependent? Obviously, in its mind, things have changed from when it first promised to continue raising rates, even though that's what it's saying it's going to do. That will occupy us for the majority of the big picture today, but we will also examine the concept of why we have slow economic growth. Now, one characteristic we've covered here on the program is how anemic this economic recovery has been. And even though there's a form of recovery, many people are saying it hasn't affected them. So what are the facts surrounding this so-called economic recovery? And why has it been so stubborn? Anything else that could jumpstart it? Well, there is, but people who are in favor of tax and spend don't want to hear it. All of that coming up next on The Big Picture as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.